So I saw a request pop up to record. Just FYI, we record everything on our end and then we upload it to the site afterwards. And you then, of course, are free to watch from there. And yeah, at any time. So and all of the Q&As going back, gosh, I think 4 years or so are also in an archive on the site. So yeah, plenty to watch. And it's all housed on the site. So welcome. This is Q&A call number one for the 18th round of SBSM. Good to see some familiar faces here and some new faces. Always exciting to see new people coming in. Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate you showing up for yourselves and doing this work because it does have such a positive ripple into humanity, which is so needed right now as the world seems to get progressively more and more crazy and reactive. So, what better thing to do than to work on coming out of that reactivity and that survival energy that drives it, right? So, let me just see Susan here. I've got some teammates here helping out in the chat. I've got Rebecca from our team. Thanks for being here, Rebecca. And I think Susan is here as well. Yep, there she is. Great. So, speaking of the chat, I'll encourage you to try and keep it kind of quiet because I won't be able to answer a lot of questions coming in live. I get usually way more questions than I can answer submitted ahead of time. In case you are new and you haven't learned this yet, all questions for these calls are submitted ahead of time on the Q&A page. And then I will do my best to pick the ones that seem to be the most relevant to as many people as possible. And if I can, I'll answer some via email if I don't get too many, which I did this round. So yeah, I'll do my best to answer as many, but I don't often get a chance to answer many that come in the chat. However, Rebecca and Susan can and will respond to you if possible in the chat. So, all righty, we will get going here. Just make sure I've got everyone. Great. Okay. So, first question. And we always keep these anonymous, just FYI, we don't read out the names of the people who submitted the questions on the call. Hello, I have always struggled with anxiety, and a few days ago I did a psilocybin mushroom ceremony for healing. I had sinus problems that made me vomit as a baby, and I couldn't take in milk. The psilocybin showed me that the origin of my sense that nothing is safe and everything is a battle was my inability to go to sleep, feeling nourished and protected then. Last few days I've wanted to eat loads. Might this be my autonomic nervous system trying to fulfill that unmet need and find regulation? Should I follow my impulse to eat a lot of healthy food? Okay, so, first things first, yeah, psychedelic resources, mushrooms, LSD, these types of things can sometimes be useful in this context. Generally speaking, what we tend to find in the context of this work is that these plant medicines tend to unpack stuff and reveal stuff that we're holding. We do then need to follow up with good somatic sober work to integrate and process what has been uncovered, I generally find. In terms of your specific question here, I mean, you certainly can try that and see how it goes. I would encourage you maybe I mean, you can try it. Instead, though, it might be more useful to focus on, if you just eat a normal amount of food, but really focus on the felt sense experience of being nourished by each bite. So it may not necessarily be useful to stuff yourself. You can, like I said, see how it feels. A lot of times when we're learning this work and we're learning to follow our impulses, we will try things out. And the point is to see, well, how do I feel? Did that make me feel better? Do I feel some sense of completion, like something is evolving or changing or shifting in me? And it may be that having an experience of getting really full will spark something up. So yeah, by all means, try it and see what it's like to maybe try really focusing on each bite, to focus on the feeling of the swallow and the food going down to the stomach, pausing, feeling what it's like to feel the sense of food arriving in the stomach. When are you really full? Can you tell that signal? So tuning your interoception into the process of eating in a very deliberate way. Another thing that's possible here, which I should mention, is that this desire to eat lots and lots of food, it could very well be rooted in what you're talking about. It also could be a form of what we call emotional eating, where there's lots of feelings that can present as hunger. So grief, loss, stress, anxiety, these feelings can percolate up in the belly and can feel sometimes like hunger, when actually it's an emotion that's needing to be expressed and resolved. So that's the other thing I would encourage you to do is check in. Like if you're feeling this sense of a lot of hunger, oh my God, I can't get enough food. I really need to eat. Well, what's going, is there some emotion there? Is there some sense of anxiety or dread or worry or fear or grief that is needing to be felt and expressed and that the food might actually suppress that? That's another possibility. So those are all different inquiries to check out as you're working with this. But yeah, it sounds like some good discoveries there in terms of, yeah, some source material. Okay. Hello. I am currently on the rolling like a baby exercise, and a lot of thoughts came up. Being helpless, being overly independent because I try to avoid dependency, afraid of rejection, etc. What do these, in quotes, releasing thoughts mean in terms of nervous system work? Is it releasing trauma as it does not come with a big charge of physical energy? All right. So thoughts on their own, no, is not trauma leaving the body. So if, again, if we think about what trauma is, it is fundamentally a survival energy. When that leaves the body, it is always a physical experience. Now, there's gradations to that experience. It can be quite subtle. It can be sort of as much as subtle as like sort of a sense of like a gentle lifting, or it may be like sometimes a freeze lifts away. It may be like a tingling or a sense of being, ooh, get little shivers and up the spine or the shoulders. And it may be very subtle and gentle, all the way to the other end of the spectrum where, like, say, a big sympathetic charge is releasing. When that happens, it generally will reach its peak of activation before it can truly let go from the system. So that means feeling peak activation, feeling that high level of fight flight energy, the emotions that come with that, maybe memories or images that were part of the original experience. All of that comes through the system with a big sympathetic release, which is why we don't focus on trying to do that in this work. Unlike a lot of other programs that may be trying to encourage that release, we really want to focus on building capacity and understanding and education so that your system starts to have the room in it to do that thing. Having worked with clients now for about 12 years, I've witnessed that these big sympathetic releases, they are the exception. Like, and when it happens, it's like, wow, awesome. Like that was the real deal. And you don't generally have like a ton of those big releases. There tend to be lots of little subtler ones, and then once in a while you get these big charges come through that complete. That's generally what I've witnessed. So going back to thoughts, the thoughts on their own are not really releasing anything. What they're doing is they're giving you information, which is also important. So I don't want to discount that. Specifically, what thoughts, these thoughts, which you are getting, so you're doing these somatic practices of rolling like a baby, and you get these thoughts like, oh man, I really, okay, I don't want to feel helpless. I don't want to feel dependent on people. No wonder I'm overly independent. Okay, that makes sense. Great. You're getting meaning about your experience, and that's really important. So it's a part of the process, but it's not releasing the survival energy itself. So this brings us to a concept that comes from Peter Levine and somatic experiencing called SIBAM. That's SIBAM. And Rebecca or Susan, if you can put this in the chat, S for sensation, I for image, B for behavior, A for affect, which is emotion and the sort of the facial expression of that, and M for meaning. So these are all components of our human experience that generally are involved in the process of life in general and in the process of renegotiating and releasing trauma. So you have the M here, the meaning. So, and you have the B, the behavior, which is the rolling like a baby, which is generating this M, the meaning. Maybe you get some images. Maybe you see an image of yourself rolling like a baby. What is the affect then? We might want to discover, oh, I have this, I'm doing this behavior, I'm rolling like a baby, which is a developmental action, and I'm getting these thoughts, which is this meaning. Okay, they're around helplessness. What does it feel like to be helpless? Can I start to tap into the emotion of that, the affect of that? Or to be overly independent, to be overly self-reliant, not wanting to connect to others. What's the feeling of that? Is there sensation present in the body? That's one of the big ones with this work. Like, what is the sensation that I'm feeling right now as I have these thoughts come to me? These are the types of things we want to start to deliberately investigate as we move through these neurosensory practices. Now, just a note, if you're new this round, this lesson that she's referencing, Rolling Like a Baby, and others that people may reference that are alumni, you may not necessarily have access to yet. So don't worry if you're like, oh, I don't see that lesson in Lab 1. Yeah, it's not in Lab 1. So if you're an alumni, you have access to all the material right now. If you're new, you just have access to each lab as we release it. So don't worry if you don't have that lesson yet if I mention it. It's just, we're not there yet. So I hope that's helpful. And just remembering, you know, for everybody, as you go into these practices, pay attention to what's coming up. And if it's just one thing, turn your attention to one of these other aspects of SIBAM. What am I actually sensing? What is the emotion? Is there any image that I get? What's the image of the sensation? That sometimes is interesting. Oh, I feel like this tingling. What would that look like? Does it have a color to it? The reason we do this is because it brings our creative mind online, our neocortex. When we're in trauma and we're in survival, we're highly dominated by our limbic brain, which is back here. So that's our brainstem, the limbic brain, the emotions, the amygdala, those more primitive centers, the emotional centers. When we bring in this kind of inquiry, like, oh, what's my sensation? What's the image of that? I wonder what, if there was a color, what would it have? When we start to investigate in that way, we're bringing on our neocortex. And that on its own starts to bring in some new information into our system, which may be used to only being in the context of what we're feeling, more associated with these more primitive brain centers. So it's a really important part of this work, this creative inquiry into what am I experiencing? Okay, moving on. In the past, my joints would contract in order to get through a tense situation. Now, as soon as my joints try to contract, my body is like, no way! It starts to shake, and if there's fear because of the current circumstances, causes the joints to contract again, I can fall over or worse. It's like I'm missing the middle ground. I know how to work with it outside of these situations, but I don't have a go-to for these situations. Side note, I noticed it in situations where healthy aggression is there, and it would help to get there. Really great noticing here. So first, I just want to say that's really cool that you used to have this automatic response where you would, everything would tense up and you would muscle and you'd push through and you'd be highly braced, right? Your body's not wanting you to do that anymore, which is actually really good. And this is one of the things we want to look for as we're moving through this work, is something that I used to always do no longer happening the same. Even if it's inconvenient and sucks, it's actually a good thing that you're having a different experience. It's one of the main things we want to look for is my response different in some way than it used to be? So it sounds like I'm missing the middle ground. So yeah, you used to tense up and push through, and now you don't do that, and you start to feel a bit of trembling. Okay, there's the underlying energy. There's that actual survival charge starting to come through, it sounds like. But then if there's more fear present, it's too much. And then everything freezes up again and you can fall over. So it's like this, okay, I'm either going to contract. Oh, I can't do that. I got to be totally open. I got to feel this. And like, that's too much. Okay, freeze up again. So yeah, you're living with extremes right now because your body is finding something different. That's just how it is. So at this period, I would, one, encourage you as much as possible to avoid a lot of situations that can trigger this as much as possible. Just limit your stress as much as you can. Maybe you do a little bit less social, you spend a bit more time to yourself, you have a bit more boundaries around your space and your energy, because your body is learning something new. It's important to protect your energy and your space and sort of cultivate safety as you can. That being said, what to do in the moment if this arises? So one thing to really tune into is, can you find support from your skeleton, from your bones? Really tuning into your posture. So if you start to feel this sense of like everything is wanting to constrict, but wait, no, my body doesn't want to do that. Okay, I'm starting to feel this trembling coming through. At that moment, tap into the principles of potent posture. See if you can really find your feet under you. Feel how the bones of your legs can support you. Right? You don't need to rely just on the musculature. See if you can find potency in your skeleton with your feet on the ground. If it's helpful and available, sit down. Like, just have a seat as soon as you start noticing this experience happening, because that's going to give you a broader base of support and lessen the chance of falling over. I think that there, like, you notice situations where healthy aggression is there would help to get there. Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about. Tapping into your posture, the strength of your bones, is a good way to start to support your ability to access that healthy aggression. Again, healthy aggression is something we get to later, but it is, yeah, an important part of this work, which is how to use the energy of anger or potency or assertiveness in a healthy way, in a way that supports you and everyone around you in a positive way. The other thing I would suggest is, when this is not happening, focus on the diaphragm and joints lessons. These are, again, later in the course, but this is an alumni. So focus on the joints and diaphragm lessons, bringing space into these structures that have this pattern of like constrict, constrict. Do that proactively for a while and just work on bringing in a sense of spaciousness into the joints and into these chambers of the body. Okay. So essentially, you're building that middle ground that you're looking for. And in order to build it, you need to maybe protect your space a little bit, have some boundaries, and focus on the principles of potency and spaciousness in the joints and diaphragms. Hello, Seth. This is my 8th round. I often dissociate or distract when trying to feel my emotions in my body. My mind goes into analyzing rather than allowing me to fully feel. Alternatively, I might totally space out. I never realized until recently how afraid I am to fully feel, which is weird because I'm also a very feeling person. How can I unlearn this strong sort of distracting, dissociating response and start feeling for real? Okay. So yeah, if you're distracting or dissociating or spacing out when you're trying to feel your body, that's all the same kind of protective mechanism of, it's a form of dissociation, all of it. And that you're coming away from your felt sense experience, and you're in your mind. Now, when you say you're a very feeling person, I totally believe you. It sounds like your emotions are probably so strong that it's tough to feel them as sensations, or scary to feel them as sensations. And so it maybe is a little safer to just sort of be in your head or to space out. Totally makes sense. It's a self-protection strategy. And this is just one of the ways that we adapt when we've experienced a lot of overwhelming stuff. I wish there was a easy, technique or something that I could just say, like, okay, well, just do this and it'll all be fine. It is a matter of practice, practice, practice. And what you need to do is allow yourself to do it in little bits. So titration, 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 one drop at a time. It's a process of, okay, I notice I'm not wanting to feel. I'm going to deliberately choose to feel. And I know that I can come back to my head at any time. I can space out at any time. I can go to my resources at any time. Maybe I'm only spending a few seconds in there, but you got to start making that effort consistently, because the only way to change such a well-worn protective mechanism is to deliberately choose to do something else in those moments that you find it happening. Now, it's possible that you could be supported well by doing some private sessions for a period of time to help you get into this process of feeling your body more. If you've been through eighth rounds and you're discovering this now, it's possible, and I don't know if you've done private work, but it's possible that now that you have all these tools and your awareness from the program, maybe your system just needs another caring person to be present to provide a little extra safety. That is part of it sometimes. Sometimes we just need to have an ally for a little bit who is somatically informed and who is aware of the ability to just tune in and support your system in what it's feeling. Also, a good practitioner may be able to help, notice like, oh, it looks like this is maybe a little too much. Why don't you just, come back to me, come back to your environment. It's okay, So having that ally and that real-time support could potentially be helpful for a little bit in guiding this process of titration into the body. In terms of specifically, like, what do you mean? How do I feel into my body? Well, like I mentioned before, the diaphragms, the joints, these are very specific guided practices into different chambers and areas of the body. But just in general, it means you bring your attention from focusing on what's happening here, and you say to yourself, well, am I breathing? That's a good place to start. Okay, I must be breathing because I'm alive. Okay, where is my breath going? Am I breathing into my chest? Am I breathing into my belly? Oh, it feels kind of tight. Okay, congratulations. You just spent a little while feeling into your body and noticing what was happening. Maybe that's enough. Then maybe you come back. Okay, I can tell that my breathing's a little tight. Where is it tight? Oh, my chest is a little tight. Okay, I'm just going to notice that. And then maybe I come out and do something else. So little dips, little dips. And sometimes the breath is a doorway into that because it's something that we can control and it's also autonomic. It's both. So it can act as a bridge sometimes. You're just going to be breathing even if you're not paying attention, or you can pay attention and discover how you're breathing. And then you can choose to maybe breathe a little differently. Or maybe you choose to, like, I'm going to bring some space deliberately into the area that I feel tightness. What happens if I do that? Oh, then I feel something happening. That feels a little scary. Okay, I'm going to back away from that. I'm going to go watch a show for a little while or whatever, right? So it's okay to dip in and out. It's okay to resource. It's okay to distract yourself, but you also got to do something else. You got to choose over and over and over and over again for years and years and years sometimes to choose something else. It's like you're learning a new skill, and it takes practice. Okay, let's see, here we go. I feel emotions on the inside, but I struggle to appropriately emote at the proper times. So I may grin when others cry, laugh when others wouldn't, kindly smile when I'm mad, be stoic when I'm excited, and I'm resistant to playfulness. My internal feelings and external behaviors are mismatched in many social situations. What causes this external internal mismatch in social engagement? How can I appropriately engage with others? And how can I correct this mismatch? Okay, so one piece at a time here. What causes this? This is a really, you know, pretty common thing. It's what happens when, as a young person growing up, our authenticity is not supported, or it's ridiculed or gaslit, or we're told we're not feeling what we're feeling. We're told it's not okay to feel what we're feeling. We're told, oh, girls aren't supposed to do that. Boys aren't supposed to do that, right? It can come in so many ways, through societal conditioning and expectations, mostly through our parents most of the time. It can also be through teachers. It can be through siblings, through peers, right? It comes in all the different ways in which we get messaging that what I'm feeling authentically is not okay. And that's how it happens. So we learn, instead of just allowing our authentic experience to be present and we feel it and we express it and everything is congruent and aligned, instead we have to do this sort of strategizing, like, oh, I'm feeling this, but that's not okay. I better present this because this is okay. And that's how you get this conundrum where it's like, I'm feeling angry, but it's not okay to be angry. Because when I was angry, I got spanked or I got yelled at. Something bad happened. So I better smile instead. Pretend everything's okay, even though I'm seething. Right? It's self-protection because we were told that our authenticity wasn't okay. In terms of how to resolve this mismatch, it comes from being congruent with yourself first. So I wouldn't try to worry so much about like resolving this in the context of social situations yet. I would practice on your own. So that means when you feel, you notice you're feeling something, really honoring that. Because your authenticity wasn't supported and honored in the way it should have been by the people who were supposed to do that, it's something you now have to do for yourself. You have to show up for yourself and your own authentic experience. And you, it may be as simple as naming it. Like, that's maybe how you start. I notice I'm feeling something. Okay, what is it? I'm feeling angry. Okay. Hello, anger. Thanks for being here. You know, welcome. What would this anger, what does it feel like? Oh, it feels like tension. It feels like heat. How would it express? How does anger look? What do I look like when I'm angry? This is a place where mirrors can sometimes be quite helpful, to witness our own expression being congruent with our own feeling on the inside, to see what it's like for ourselves to be in that kind of matchup, so you're no longer mismatched. So that's what I would suggest doing to start, like really practicing that kind of internal examination and authentic expression with yourself. Then, once you start to feel that ability to do that, it's going to be a matter of catching it, right? When you're in social situations. My hunch is, if you start to do this with yourself first, it might lead to quite a bit of emotion coming through and processing through the system, like grief and anger and rage, and basically the natural responses of a human being to having our authenticity suppressed. It is really critically important. Later on in the course, we'll release an additional resource, but you can actually go look it up now if you want, because it's open source. But it's a talk by Gabor Mate, and if Susan Rebecca, if you can find this, it's called The Need for Authenticity. And it's incredibly powerful talk. And in a nutshell, what he is talking about is how when we are little ones, we have two primary survival needs: attachment and authenticity. In terms of course, we need food and nourishment and all that stuff. But relationally, attachment, we need healthy, secure attachment, and we need authenticity. They're both survival needs. They're both equally important for proper development. However, if our authenticity is judged, threatened, we get told it's not right, then this can happen as early as infancy, just through facial expressions. Like, we learn to read, like, ooh, that wasn't okay. We start picking that stuff up real, real early. So if that happens, and we learn that our authenticity is maybe not okay, we will suppress our authenticity in order to preserve the attachment. Very rarely will we abandon the attachment in order to preserve our authenticity, because as a little one, we simply can't. We need our parents and our family system to survive. Maybe later on, as a teenager, you may see that, right? And that's the teenager that rebels, that runs away. They're preserving their authenticity and sacrificing the attachment, which at that stage is actually often healthier. Like the black sheep, so-called, of the family, the kids who are super rebellious, who are angry, who are runaway, often end up being quite a bit more healthy in the long run than those who stay in the system. So authenticity and attachment, both equally important. And we will tend to suppress our authenticity as young ones in order to preserve the attachment. So go check out that video at some point if you like. It's a very good video. Okay. Hello, this is my third round, and I can't seem to make it past lab three. I have major resistance to doing any of the labs. It feels like I'm going against the programming of my narcissistic parents. How do I do this work when I feel like it's going against the message that I should be punished for being disloyal? And then I fulfill that through self-sabotage. Okay. So, how do I do this work when I feel like it's going against the message that I should be punished for being disloyal? Well, there's a shit ton there to unpack. First off, I think you need to accept that that message is bullshit, okay? That is not a message you need to hold on to, okay? That is toxic programming that you received. So just on a mental level, take note, that message, that program is wrong. That is incorrect. That is toxic. That is not what I need. I'm curious if you're still in relationship with your parents. If so, it might be a helpful idea to have a little pause. Put a little boundary up, take some space from them, as long as you need. And because if you're still, as an adult, thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to get in trouble, essentially is what you're saying here. If I do this, if I get better, if I heal, I'm going to get in trouble from my parents. So if your parents are still around and you're in relationship with them, I would suggest having a boundary for a while of no contact, because you need to free yourself up from that. And you don't have to be mean about it, you know. You can be, hey, I'm working through some stuff. I need to have space and time and just not to communicate with any family for a while. If they then go into total rage, control, guilting, gaslighting, etc., then guess what? There's confirmation that you really need to have a boundary with your parents, okay? It's just the way it is with this work sometimes. If our parents were abusive and part of the problem, there may be chapters of time where we need to have space away from them so that we can start to build something else. Because as long as we're maintaining that connection, all that programming comes with it. And it can be a lot more difficult to change it while we're maintaining that relationship. So consider that. And if your parents are supportive, they'll be fine. Like, I have a son who's now an adult. If he said to me, Dad, you know what? I mean, I love talking to you, but I'm working through some stuff that happened when we were kids, and I need to not talk to you for a while. I need to work this out. I would be fucking stoked. Yay! All right. Awesome. Like, that's fantastic. Go, dude. Go do your thing. That's a supportive parent. If your parents, like, then goes into guilt mode, like, oh my God, then that's just more of the same abuse pattern continuing. So give yourself permission to free yourself up from that incorrect programming. Now, another thing you want to ask yourself, you know, in determining this is, do you really want to get better? Do you really want to get better? If so, that's what you're going to need to do. You got to accept that this message and this program is wrong, and you have every right to go against it. The other thing I'm hearing is that there's currently a lot of aggression going inwards in this question. There's a lot of self-judgment, self-criticism, I'm doing something wrong. So it sounds to me like you probably received a lot of aggression from your parents that's been internalized and now it's pointing at you, from you. So it needs to be directed to the right place, which, you know, again, we will get into how to do this later on. But again, just to consider for yourself, wow, I'm kind of being mad at myself by telling myself that it's not okay for me to heal. I'm going to actually choose to just decide, at least on a mental level, that's not true. I don't accept that. Now, if possible, it may be useful to start to just connect to some of the very basics of healthy aggression. And again, we get into this much more in detail later on. But for now, I would say, like, if you start to get these thoughts and these programs come in, see what happens if you, well, okay, I feel that. Notice that happening. I'm going to sit up. I'm going to get over my pelvis. And I'm going to feel my ability to be erect through my spine. And I'm going to feel my sit bones on the chair. And maybe you just give your fists a little squeeze. And just see what that feels like. Because it'll start to redirect the pathway of aggression. You don't have to do anything big or cathartic. I would like you to avoid that, actually. Just see if you can connect to a bit of your potency through this changing your posture, giving your fist a little squeeze. Maybe you just sort of feel your, press your heels into the floor a little bit, and then just let it go and see what it's like to bring in a very small little intervention like that somatically, as well as, yes, maybe consciously challenge that belief and say, no, that's wrong. I deserve to heal. All right. Hi there. Oh, wait, before I get this, let me just check the time. Okay, yeah, we'll do one more and then we'll have a little pause. Hi there. I'm an alumni, round 4, with early developmental trauma. I've noticed a coupling of fear and crying. When I get scared that someone is mad at me, I start to cry. For example, talking to my husband, I feel he's mad at me. I ask him and confirm he is not mad at me, but then I keep crying. Then he gets mad at me because I'm still crying. In other situations, I get startled and yell or jump, but when a man seems mad at me, I might cry. As a kid, my dad would get mad and yell or spank. How to uncouple fear and crying? Okay. So another result of authenticity being suppressed, but in this case, it was basically just helplessness because you couldn't fight back. So you were on the receiving end of rage and aggression from your dad, and you were a kid. You couldn't do anything. So you then went into crying, which is a natural expression of being scared as a kid. Like, that's just normal. Now it probably happened enough that yes, it's coupled. So anytime you feel any sense of anger or aggression from a man specifically, it sounds like, it triggers this automatic crying response. I wonder if, as a kid, if you would go into crying, would it then maybe help redirect your dad's energy? Like, maybe he wouldn't be so mad if you were still crying? I don't know. But it sounds like it's either just a natural response that happened as a kid and now it's tightly bound with the experience of fear, or maybe it also is a form of self-protection. As like, maybe they won't be so mad at me if I am just in tears here. Another thing I want to, now I don't know if, it sounds like this is a real situation. So the other thing I want to point at is, like, you know, why is your husband getting mad at you for crying? Like, that's not exactly the most supportive. So that might be another thing to consider there. If you're talking to your husband, you feel he's mad at you, you ask him, he confirms he's not mad at me, and then you keep crying and he gets mad at me. Well, I don't think there may be some stuff under the surface there for your husband. You know, he's got some stuff going on. I just like, it probably triggers his own fears. I just saw in the chat. Yeah. Yeah. Or his own aggression. Like, why is he getting mad at your tears? So, you know, there's some stuff maybe for your husband to unpack there as well. So essentially, there's a lot of reactivity in the system, which is, you know, normal. That's what I'm hearing. There's, like you said also, like, you may get startled in other situations or yell and jump, right? So there's a lot of reactivity in the system. One of the ways in which we can start to work with that somatically is, again, this idea of more space. Like, if we go to the analogy of the swimming pool and the beach balls, right? There's just like the reason there's so much reactivity is because there's so much charge in the system and not a lot of space in there. And so there's all this energy in there kind of jostling around, and some impulse comes in, like some input, and bam, it's like, wow, it explodes because it can't hold anymore. So space, how can you bring more space into your system? Since you are an alumni, again, you have access to all the lessons. What lessons for you help you feel a sense of expansiveness, a bit more ease, a bit more space? Maybe it's the layers lesson or the joints and diaphragms. Maybe it's cultivating the inhale or cultivating the exhale. See what works for you to cultivate a sense of more space. How can I have more space? As you do that, some of these charges that are waiting in there, jostling around, might start to come out on their own without being poked at, right? And that's kind of what we want. We want to try to get to this stuff without the trigger, because once we're triggered, it can be hard to unravel and uncouple these things because we're already in survival, right? It's kind of like we're already falling down the stairs. And it's like, once you start falling down the stairs, it's hard to stop yourself. But if at the top, as you start to feel that, oh, here's that trigger, or if you're investigating deliberately and you encounter like, oh, this is that sensation, it can be much easier to sort of go deliberately and pause and investigate, feel, express without the trigger. So that's where this kind of deliberate exploration comes in. That's what it's all about. Like, how can I find more space? Oh, as I find more space, I feel these tears start to come. And there's no one being mad at you. So, okay, you're starting to get access more directly to what's waiting in the system. Another thing that you might check out is like, well, what are the sensations of the fear? So say this happens and yes, you notice you go into crying. Are you fixated then on the crying? Like really, are you thinking about the thoughts that are associated with the crying? Are you really just focusing on the action of the tears or the sobs? What happened to the fear? Right. So how can you start to notice the sensations of the fear that probably are happening first? And that will be something like tightness in the chest, shortness of breath, maybe a tightness in the throat. It tends to present, or maybe a knot in the belly. Right? Fear is often some kind of constriction experience somewhere in the body. So that's another thing to start to investigate, is the sensations of fear. And maybe you do that in hindsight. Like sometimes you have to reverse engineer this stuff. Like say, for example, this scenario you describe happens, you get triggered. Oh my gosh, I go into crying. Okay, this is my pattern. After it's over, can you sort of think back, like what happened there? Okay, I started crying, but what happened before that? I did feel a sense of fear. What was that like? Oh yeah, okay, yeah, I was feeling really tight in my chest. That's what it was. So just becoming aware of what's happening, right? All right, let's take a little pause before we continue on, so you can get a drink or go have a pee or whatever you need to do, attend to your body, maybe stretch, walk around, come away from the screen, and we will just come back here in like 3 or 4 minutes. All right, welcome back. So before I move on, I was just scanning the chat. Noticed a question up top. Hello, Seth, and everyone. I'd like to ask, since my head has become very busy since trying to connect with my body, meditation techniques haven't helped. Any tips on how to stay with my feelings? And then I saw just a comment from someone down below. Who's talking about a teacher she has who suggests using a 90-second timer, or it doesn't really matter the time, but just setting a timer and like you literally just sit in the chair with the timer set, notice sensations in the body without judgment or stories, and when the timer goes off, go back into your life. Cool. That's a creative way to do it. Essentially, you don't, well, the first thing I would say, and this, connects to questions I've already answered, but you don't have to stay with your feelings. You need to learn to feel your feelings in your body. And if you think like, I have to stay with it, that alone might be too much pressure. So yeah, it's okay. Dip in, dip out. I want to learn to feel my feelings in my body rather than I need to learn, I must stay with it, right? That's going to put pressure on you. So yeah, that's kind of a cool idea. You could use a timer, or you could just do it organically. Like, just how long do I want to feel this stuff? Like, one of the things that's really important in this work is learning our capacity and learning our window of tolerance. That's something that actually can take a long time because a lot of us learn to function just in survival mode and we have a sense of our capacity and ability that's actually false. It's built on survival energy and pushing through or being in functional freeze. So learning what our real capacity is for being with our body, that's a really important part of this work. And if setting a timer like gives you a nice, easy framework for starting to do that, that's a great idea. Sure. Maybe like you do that, you start with like 90 seconds and yep, I can totally do that. Or that felt like a little too much. Maybe I should do 60 seconds. Just yeah, whatever you need to do to start to learn. How much time can I really tolerate feeling what I'm actually feeling? Believe it or not, you get to a place where that's all you're doing all the time is just feeling what you're actually feeling in your body, and that's how you live. But that's like a destination that you work towards. It's hard to, we don't want to put pressure on ourselves that like I have to just stay with my feelings all the time. No, that would be way too much for almost everybody starting this work. So learn to dip in and out, learn what your capacity is. All right. This is my second round. I've been doing all the exercises through the summer, healthy aggression the least, because I don't feel I'm ready yet. A month ago, my right upper stomach slash back area close to the kidney started to hurt. I checked with three different doctors, and it seems like nothing at all is wrong. It hurts most around 2 o'clock in the morning. During the day, I'm okay and I can function. Any suggestions? P.S. I either get sick or I yawn as the result of this work, which seems like extremes. Thank you. Okay. So if you are feeling a sense of, did you say specifically what? It started to hurt. So I don't know exactly what that means, but my sense is it's like maybe a pinging kind of sharp sensation or a tightness. This is likely your fascia starting to shift around the kidney there. I can't know for sure, but if you've had three different doctors check you out and there's nothing wrong at all, then it is, this is how it feels when our fascia starts to let go. So fascia, if you don't know, is this amazing stuff that it's what's in between your skin and your musculature. Like for example, like if you grab your forearm and you hold onto your skin, you can still rotate your arm like this. Like you can feel your skin gliding over the musculature by holding tightly onto the skin. That gliding happens because of the fascia. It's this slippery layer in between the musculature and the skin. It also wraps all of our organs as well, and sometimes goes through the organs. It's a huge global system in our body that we are learning more and more about all the time. It seems to actually almost be its own form of nervous system in that the way that it communicates with the body. It's an incredible system. And one of the things that it does in the context of trauma is brace. So it's supposed to be all slippery and glidey and smooth, but when we're under chronic strain and stress, it tends to tighten up. And this stuff that can be like super supple can also be like steel. It can get extremely rigid and hard. And when it's been that way and it starts to let go, it's painful. It feels like you describe, often around the kidneys, as the kidneys start to let go a little bit, people start to feel pain and these little jolting, little shooting, sort of sharp sensations in that area. That's like the fascia that's been rigid starting to soften. A lot of the time, that's what it is. So that's a strong possibility since you've been doing this work for a couple rounds. Perhaps your kidneys are starting to let go a little bit, which would be great. And yeah, it's not uncommon to feel temporary discomfort because of that. Another thing is it's possible there's something going on with your liver just because 2 a.m. to 3 a.m. is on the Chinese medicine clock. That's basically the time of the liver. So if you're feeling pain or you get woken up during that time of the night, according to that system, there may be something happening with the liver. But again, like you've had things checked out, so it sounds like that's probably not the case. But it could be fascial around the liver as well. So my hunch is it's like, yes, the fascia letting go. And yeah, the fascia can do all, we can have all sorts of sensations in the fascia, burning, tingling, sharp shooting pains, really pleasant tingling, lovely sensations, softening. There's all sorts of experiences. I just saw a thing pop up asking if we had recommendations for working with fascia. There's lots of ways that one can work with fascia. I have a couple things here. I'll see if I can, let's see, I think I have them bookmarked, which I'll just pull up real quick. Because we do have a colleague who works with fascia and teaches people to work with their fascia. And she's lovely. So I'm just going to look those up real quick because I have them right here. Okay. So I'm just going to pop these into the chat. There's lots of ways to work with fascia. So there's people who are, that's what their work is as body workers. Myofascial practitioners, Rolfers work a ton with fascia, osteopaths. There's lots of people who work with fascia. It can be sometimes intense. So I like to point people to Miss Savannah here. I'm just popping a couple playlists in the chat here. There we go. Those are both playlists from our colleague Savannah working with fascia. And it's self-directed work and can be a nice way to start exploring this stuff. Bowen therapy is another form of body work that is very gentle and can be a nice intro into working with fascia. And that's something I've experienced myself and thought was quite good. Okay, getting back to the question. So yeah, that's probably what's going on, is my hunch. And then just a note here where you say, I either get sick or I yawn as the result of this work. So I'm not 100% sure what you mean. That could either be totally normal or kind of extreme, as you say. So if you mean you feel a little like, ugh, like you feel detoxy, you feel kind of flu-like or sicky after you do some work, that's totally normal. That's the system detoxing. This can happen through the fascia actually softening. The fascia can tend to hold toxins as well. There can be toxins and various stuff stored in the organs, chemicals. There can be stuff in the musculature. There's all sorts of ways in which our bodies can hold on to stuff when we're especially living with lots of freeze. So if you feel a little sick as you start to do some of this work, that's totally normal. Also, yawning, that's a parasympathetic response. So cool. Like you start to do this work and you settle a little bit. Cool. Okay, so that's one scenario. Yeah, and flu-like, I mean just like a little, not like a full-on flu for weeks, but like you feel a little flu-like, you feel a little detoxy, a little, ugh, like there's something coming through. Now, if you like are yawning uncontrollably nonstop, just you keep on doing it, you can't stop. That is more like a freeze. That's more of a freeze coming on, and it's an indication that you're maybe doing too much. Likewise, if you say I get sick, if you mean like you actually throw up, if that's what you mean, yes, that's extreme, and again, an indication that you're probably doing too much, and you need to titrate more and do less. So, I hope I covered all the bases there. Hi, I'm an alumni. I think I'm more aware of my stored survival stress and therefore anger. I'm having issues though finding the person to be angry with. Who's the right person? What could I do if I can't find someone or I feel bad for being healthy, using healthy aggression with the wrong person? When I don't find someone, the anger goes inward and I get chest pains and ruminate, have headaches. Thanks. I hope this makes sense. Totally makes sense. The thing that you need to understand is that you don't have to have a person to be mad at. Healthy aggression is about working with the energy of aggression directly in the body using the physicality. You don't have to direct it at a person. Like I can sit here, and and all right, I just let a little aggression come through in a healthy way that felt really empowering. I'm not really angry right now, so I'm pretending, but yeah, like that's healthy aggression work. I'm not needing to imagine destroying somebody. So you can do the healthy aggression work just using your body, using your musculature, your face, your sounds, your eyes, all of that stuff. Now, but I also got to ask, like, well, who hurt you? Like, if you want to know who the right person is, who is the one who hurt you? Who is the one who abused you? That's the right person. Now, what we're talking about here a bit is a form of the anger work called annihilation work. Now, again, this is quite advanced. We get into this later in the course. But this is where you bring in the healthy aggression practices of using your physicality to allow sympathetic charge, fight response to come through, and you allow yourself a fantasy of imagining destroying the person while being embodied in that process. Very advanced work. Because you have to stay connected to yourself, your feelings, your sensations, your environment, and your fantasy. And it all has to happen at the same time while staying grounded, embodied, etc. So it's really advanced work, which we do get into later on. But that's, who hurt you? Who is the one who abused you? That's where this energy wants to go. When we're talking about that kind of work, it's about finding the stuff that never got to happen and allowing it to happen. I never got to defend myself from my dad who would scream at me and spank me. So I'm going to destroy him using this practice. And man, does it feel good. And nobody gets hurt. And then I have a much better relationship with my actual dad. That's how it's supposed to work and how it does work. But it takes some time to build that capacity to do that. If you misdirect your anger, if you, because healthy aggression work, annihilation work isn't about getting angry at people. It's about, again, it's about embodying the energy of self-protection and aggression in a healthy way. So if you find yourself that, like, oops, I actually got angry or I directed anger and aggression at a person that was wrong, well, then you just have to apologize and explain and communicate and say, sorry about that. And again, just remember, you don't even have to have a person in mind. Sometimes there is no image. Sometimes maybe it's early developmental trauma, or maybe like you were hurt by like the institutions of life, and you have to use I'm gonna turn into a giant and destroy my school. I'm gonna crush the building with my feet, and sometimes you use symbols if it's more abstract, so you can be creative. But yeah, you don't have to have a person. You can just use the physicality. Hello, I'm an alumni, early developmental trauma. My husband will often make comments in an angry tone to me that makes me feel guilty about something that isn't my fault. Telling me, for example, that he's the only one who comes through for the family when we're all trying our best. I start to feel guilty, angry, and hurt. It gets in my head and I believe it. I start to feel scared and pull away, and I also tend to think about what he said over and over. What can I do from the program to help myself? Oh boy. Well, so yeah, here's another one where we got to look at the elephant in the room, which is the husband. Now, yes, there is stuff you can do in the program, which I'll get to. But one of the first principles of this work is we have to have a safe enough environment. If we are being abused in real time, we cannot do this work, because the whole point is to get at the stored survival stress in our system. If we are constantly under real threat, which is what's happening here, you can't progress because you're always getting bombarded with new stuff. So you spend all your time just managing and trying to deal with the present reality. The foundation of this work is a safe enough environment. It doesn't have to be perfect, but if you are receiving emotional abuse, which is what this is, you got to look at your relationships if you want to progress. It's just the way it is. It's likely that this relationship with your husband is echoing an earlier relationship with a parent. It's probably a similar dynamic that you may have had with a teacher or a dad or a mom or some other figure who was abusive. And that's what we tend to do until stuff gets resolved. We just live with it. Sorry, I got distracted by, I'm just going to close the chat here, because I'm seeing things that I want to respond to, and I just got to leave it. So you got to look at your relationships. You got to look at, how is my environment? Now, it doesn't have to be perfect. Again, like, maybe this, your husband is okay most of the time, but then he does this thing. He does this thing that's abusive. Well, then you got to consider couples therapy. Is he open to change? Is he open to working on himself? If he's yelling at you and being angry with you and guilting you and telling you, like, I'm the only one who does anything, you're not pulling your weight, you know, if he's in this narrative that is false and he's projecting it all at you, that's abusive. And it needs to change. So maybe, you know, you don't have to go full nuclear and leave the husband, but you got to at least engage in a process of therapy with him. And like, he has to be open to changing that. If he is totally not open to that, and it's all your problem, it's all everybody else's problem, I'm fine, well, then there's not a lot of hope to progress until something changes there. I hate to be that blunt, but that's just how it is. I actually have, as part of my criteria for working with clients privately, I have it in my terms and conditions that if you're in an abusive relationship and you're totally not open to leaving that, I can't work with you, because we're just wasting our time. You got to have a safe enough environment that your system can start to let go of the old stuff, which means you're not taking in new stuff. Now, if there is possibility for change in that relationship, it's going to involve probably outside support, like a couples therapist, and it's going to involve you learning to be assertive. So it means when he sends that stuff your way, you learn to say, hey, that's not okay. That's not all that's going on here. And you're being really angry right now, and I don't want to be spoken to in this way. And if the thought of saying any of those things is crazy or terrifying, then yeah, there's a lot to do there in terms of connecting to your own aggression, to your own capacity, to your ability to be assertive and stand up for yourself. And again, it can be hard to develop any of those qualities if you're feeling under threat in real time. So if there is a possibility to work through it, outside support, he's got to be open to change. You're going to want to focus on developing your connection to your potency, your ability to be assertive. Posture, again, is a huge part of this. All right, if I'm receiving something and I like that's like this that you're describing, like a very natural thing that happens is we tend to sink or collapse in the posture, which supports feelings of helplessness. So how can you connect to the principles of potent posture? Go back to that lesson. And like, when this is happening, no, I'm going to be more potent in my posture. I'm going to be more erect. I'm going to find my ability to be supported by my skeleton. I'm going to let my shoulders drop. I'm going to let my chest lift. I'm going to let my tailbone sort of lift a little bit so my spine can lengthen. Just working posturally, see how that brings in a different signal into the system. Okay. Where are we at? 1108. Okay. How do I know if pushing myself out for a walk is doing me any good? I return quite activated. I feel bracing in my diaphragms as intention. I return home and immediately lay down and breathe to resource after gulping down a glass of cold water first. I seem to feel a need to get outside and get this nervous energy out of me, but then faced with overwhelming tension that feels like bracing from a past event. Okay, so what's happening here is as you go into movement, healthy movement, it's sparking up your sympathetic system, which is good. That's how it's supposed to work. But then, because your sympathetic nervous system is getting activated by the motion, it's then grabbing on to all the sympathetic-y stuff in your system from the past. So yes, it sounds like your perception is correct. And it's then wanting to come through, and it sounds like that's feeling overwhelming to your system, so everything tightens up. Right? So we do need to move. We need to walk. We need to be vigorous with our bodies as much as possible as humans. And if that movement is triggering a lot of sympathetic energy, we need to work with that as well. So coming home and feeling all full of tension and then laying down and trying to relax may not be the most supportive of your system. It may be that you actually need to work with that sympathetic stuff that's coming up. So maybe instead of laying down, just stand there and feel into where it's tight and see if you can bring in a bit of space. Maybe something needs to express through the system, right? It sounds like there's a, there's some kind of grr, there's some kind of, there's some kind of aggression, there's some kind of fight flight energy that needs to come through. Maybe you sit down and you just like stomp your legs a bunch and let them run on the ground and you feel your ability to like move faster, but you're sitting. So rather than trying to calm down, work with the energy, work with the sympathetic energy. See what that's like. And know again that you don't have to overwhelm yourself. Don't like, you know, if that feels like way too much, maybe you just do a little of that. Or maybe you just work with sound instead of a lot of vigorous movement. There's lots of ways to get sympathetic-y stuff moving through the system. Like little sound through the body. That alone can let some energy move through that's related to this fight-flight stuff that's wanting to come through. And another thing to notice is like, how can you start to connect that stuff on your walk? So, of course, you don't want to like be necessarily yelling and screaming and, you know, when you're out in public, but, you know, maybe there's a nice little, you know, bush alcove somewhere where you get behind some trees or, you know, go push on a rock or, you know, push against a tree or something. Or, you know, how might you find some creative ways to work a little bit with this energy while you're on your walk? It doesn't have to be huge, but maybe you pick up your pace. Maybe you make a little sound. Maybe you breathe a little bit more. Or you try the other way. Maybe you just do less. Maybe you step out, you go for a little walk, you start to feel the first inkling of this stuff bubbling up, and then you go back to your safe space and you work with that little bit. You work with that little bit. So how you work with this is going to depend on your capacity. And so you need to know what that is. Again, sometimes that happens through experimentation. Okay. Hi, Seth. I'm in round 5. I noticed a new facial expression in the past months. Chin contracted up to create downturned lips. I noticed it during sleepy mornings or while having a normal bowel movement or when getting a massage, so only when I am most relaxed. Objectively, it may look like sadness or helplessness or uncertainty, but I don't feel any of these feelings when the facial expression comes. I only feel relaxed. Any advice? So the first thing to note, like I've said before, any new thing is to be celebrated and noticed. Like, yay, that's a different experience. I never noticed that before. Cool. That means that something is surfacing. Something is arising through the system, which is what we want. And now it's a facial expression. So cool. That's so kind of like, is what I sort of get the image of when you say lifting the chin so the lips turn down. Yeah, cool. That's something new for you. Perhaps it wasn't okay for you to feel sad, or grumpy or discontent in the past. Maybe you always had to be cheerful. Maybe everything always had to be okay. Cool. The reason it's happening while you're relaxed is because your guards are down. And that's often how this works in this work. As we start to get more capacity and safety internally, in the moments that our system is more parasympathetic and unguarded, stuff may just organically arise. And you don't have to really try to figure it out too much. Just let it happen. Notice it. It's possible that eventually some emotion will be part of it, or maybe not. Either way is fine. Just investigate it. What's happening in your belly? When this is happening on your face, what's going on in the stomach? What's going on in the chest? That's one thing to start checking out. What are the other sensations that are present as the facial affect is happening? Also, like, just breathe. Like, what does it feel like to, as this face is happening, breathe a little bit intentionally? Does something else happen? You know, a lot of this work is like, oh, this is happening. Interesting. I think I'll be with that. I think I'll pay attention to what else is going on. Oh, I just noticed something new happening. Okay, that's cool. Again, it's the process of inquiry, the process of creatively, kindly paying attention to ourselves. The process itself is what changes things in the system. It's the effort we make and how we show up for ourselves as our experiences arise. So for so much of us, what we received growing up, me included, is, I'm feeling this thing. No, you're wrong. You know? It's like, that's in a nutshell. So we got to counteract that with our own attention and the way in which we pay attention to ourselves. Oh, I'm experiencing this thing. How cool. Oh, I'm going to be with this. I'm going to celebrate it. You know, all right. What's going to happen next, I wonder? Now, it can be difficult to have that same kind of lens when what we're feeling is painful, but we really need to. And that's part of the work. Oh, I'm feeling intense constriction in my gut. Okay, welcome. Whew, that's intense. Oh, I wonder what the sound of that might be. Okay. Oh, interesting. As I made that sound, I felt a little vibration and something happened up here. That's the process. Investigation, expression, experimentation. And how can we do that in a way that is kindly and compassionate towards ourself and our experience? Okay, two more. Hi, Seth. I'm struggling so hard to be in my body. When I was born, my nose was bent to the left side because I had sucked my thumb for so long in my mom's tummy with a finger folded over my nose. So I was self-soothing already before birth. I came out and I didn't make a sound. The doctor took me by my legs, hung me upside down, and hit me on the back until I screamed. What are your thoughts about this? Yeah, wow. I mean, that's unfortunately, welcome to planet Earth, kid. Like, that is all too common, that kind of experience, just this kind of violence around birth. And so, of course, what he would have thought he was doing was making sure you were alive, you know? Okay, you know? But there's lots of other ways that could have happened. There's way better ways to support, you know, birth and connection, and you know, but his motivations were good. Wanted to make sure you could breathe, that you were alive. So, but yeah, that's a really rude awakening. That's a, and it sounds like you were already in a lot of high stress in the womb, which is, you know, yeah, happens. So your system was probably likely largely dominated by freeze when you came out, which is why you didn't make any sound. And then, bam, welcome to sympathetic overwhelm. So yeah, that's a real tough way to start. and not that uncommon when you're talking about medicalized birth. So, yeah, I have a hard time V in my body. Yeah, it makes sense. You didn't have a very good initiation into physicality. That's rough. So I think it might be helpful for a while since there is these deep, deep imprints that sound like they go back to in utero. This is what we call early developmental trauma. Really focusing on principles of what works for me to feel a little bit okay. We'll talk about this more on the calls that are specifically about early developmental trauma. But when there's these really intense early imprints that may go back even to in utero, it may not be that we want to focus on like tracking sensation and all the stuff I was talking about 5 minutes ago of like expression, feeling, finding the stuff in the body. Like that's still really important, but what may need to happen first is building your ability to just kind of feel okay. So, what are your resources? This is one of the reasons that's one of the early first lessons, researching your resources. What helps you feel a little bit okay? It's okay if that's external. It's okay if it's a cup of tea. It's okay if it's a glass of wine, whatever it is. Something you have that you can go to that helps you feel a little bit better. And then combining the use of those resources with orienting. So, I have my favorite candle I'm gonna light and put it here. And I have my cozy blanket that makes me feel safe. And I have my cup of tea right here, which is nourishing, that's relaxing. And I have my little teddy bear right here. I got all my resources around me. I'm connecting to those. I notice how that makes me feel a little bit nice, a little bit okay. Okay, I'm just gonna orient a little bit. I'm just gonna see what's right here. I'm not even going to look outside, maybe at first. Like, here's my teacup. There's my bear. Okay. Maybe it starts that way with connecting deliberately to your environment rather than what's happening in here in a context that's supported by your resources. That's often how we need to start with early developmental trauma because the world was so overwhelming from the get-go. You got to build the ability just to notice okayness, to notice that you can be present in your body, connected to the environment in the present, and it can feel okay. So that's how I'd suggest starting. And then as you move through the program, I don't think you say whether you're an alumni or not. No, you don't. As you move through the program, just take note which practices feel more accessible to you. And you might want to always engage in the neurosensory exercises or even the educational videos, again, with all your resources right there online so that you can go to them at any time. You can pause at any time, right? And that's how I would encourage you to approach it. Just slowly, carefully, well supported by resources. And at first, just see if you can be with what's out here. And then maybe you notice, like, okay, I'm feeling kind of okay. I got my blankie, I got my tea, there's my candle. I'm feeling kind of okay. Okay, maybe I'll just notice that I'm breathing. Okay, that's enough. You know, like literally, little moments, building the capacity. Okay, last question. Hi Seth, I'm a fourth timer with early developmental trauma and fibro. Had very good progress with SBSM. My current challenge is the habit of constantly worrying and feeling guilty. When I objectively can't find any reason for these, I feel worried about that. I realize this was a survival mechanism, but I'm sick of this pattern. How to change it? All right. So, of course, when this is going on, it's not about what's really happening now. From what you describe, this is just survival energy is present and it will try to latch on to anything, right? So there is an anxiety present in the body and then the mind will try to find justifications for it. But that doesn't feel right. Oh my gosh, if that's not what I'm worried about, what am I worried about? Oh my God, I don't know, Right? So it's first understanding that it's not actually about anything out here, most likely. Now, things in our world can trigger it, right? Like, oh, I've got that deadline coming up, and then that triggers a disproportionate amount of anxiety, and it seems to all be about the deadline, but it's very little about the deadline. It's about the 20 years that happened before. So that's essentially what's going on. And we need to work with the body directly when this is happening, not try to figure out what am I really worried about. Because you won't, that's like, there is no really useful information there unless you start to think, like, oh, well, this is not about now. Ah, this is how I felt when my fourth grade teacher would scream at me. So this is probably a little bit about that. Okay, so that is maybe useful. But then, what is the felt sense of the worry? What is the felt sense of the guilty feeling? What's going on in the sensations in the body as you're having these thoughts and trying to find like what the reason is? That's the way we can tend to break this cycle, because with the mind trying to find the thing, it becomes a self-perpetuating loop that just doesn't go anywhere. Right? You have the survival already there. And so I'm trying to find the thing that I'm worried about. And maybe it's that thing. Okay, yeah, that thing makes me feel worried. So then I feel more of the worry about the thing. And it's just, we can create these loops. Or yeah, we can feel like, I don't know what it is. I just feel scared. Right? So yeah, we need to work directly with that experience. Let me just look at my notes for a second here. If information comes to you, that's useful. And often that's how it goes, right? Like, I can't figure out what I'm really worried about. I just know that I'm worried. Okay, can I sit and just pause and be with the feelings of the worry directly? And again, like I talked about before, like, well, what's the sound? What's the sensation? What can I breathe? Am I noticing like my actual environment? Can I feel my feet? Like, various basic somatic inquiries about what's going on. How might I express this? As we start to do that kind of work and inquiry, the real reason may sometimes just arise. It just will float up like, oh my gosh, this is about this. Okay, cool. And again, that's a part of it. That's the meaning. And then you may want to ask, well, gosh, yeah, what did I want to do? Like, okay, this is about my fourth grade teacher screaming at me. This is how I felt right then. What did I want to do in that moment? I wanted to get the hell out of there. I wanted to run. Okay, my body's wanting to run from my fourth grade teacher. That's why I'm feeling worried about this deadline. Okay, got it. Run. Let your feet start to go. Let the legs start to go. See yourself fleeing the classroom. Back to some safe haven, back to some safe place in your mind. See yourself getting away. Let the body move while you're doing this. Let the energy come through. Most of you probably know the story already, but that's how this work started, essentially, is Peter Levine's first client that he just had this crazy inspiration to try this thing with. And like, holy shit, look what happened. So, if you have, I'll just very briefly, if you don't know the story, his very first client was a woman who came in because she had tons of anxiety. No one knew what to do with her. We'll just go see this guy. And he worked with her and talked with her. And at one point, just randomly said, I think her name is Nancy. Nancy, there's a tiger behind you. Run. And she just started running. And her legs just ran and ran and ran. I think it was like for 20 minutes or maybe a half an hour, her legs just went, 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 went. And then no more anxiety. It was gone. Because luckily, he got a very simple case for that first one, which where there was just this high charge of fight flight energy that needed to be expressed through the body. And because it hadn't been expressed, it was living in the mind. And that's how this work was discovered. Now, yeah, that was very fortunate because it's actually pretty rare that you can have that straightforward of a result. But it does happen, and the principle is really important to remember, which is, what is the charge in the body? What is it trying to do? How can I help support that? Through my attention, through my breath, through my imagination, through my expression, through my movement, all that stuff. Challenging as a wheelchair user. God, yeah, totally. Yep, that would be tough, but there's still many ways you can do it. If you have use of your arms, you can use your arms to squeeze, push, that kind of thing. You can use your face, you can use your breath. There's lots of ways to express sympathetic-y stuff, even just with sound, like I demonstrated earlier. So yeah, there's people who have all sorts of limitations who you can still find ways. And discovering how you can do it again is part of that creative inquiry into ourselves. So, all right, y'all. Thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to the next one, of course. If there are follow-up questions, I will open up the comment section of the Q&A page after this call. Just to be clear, that Q&A page comment section is only for follow-up questions, not for new questions. But like, if I answered one of your questions and then, but you had a follow-up, like, oh, but what about this? Feel free to ask it there. If somebody else's question sparked up something for you, please reference that if you ask about it, so I know, like, oh, this is in reference to Q&A call, because that section is only for follow-up stuff. Okay, thanks so much. We'll see you all next time. Bye for now.